First thing on the agenda, the approval of the minutes for February 22nd. And Representative McNamara, would you like to move the minutes for February 22nd, the last meeting?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of February 22nd.
Thank you. Representative McNamara moves the minutes for February 22nd. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes have been adopted. We're going to be hearing four different bills today, and we're starting off with Representative Frank Moe's bill. And Representative Moe, if you would like to move your bill.
Yes, I would, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'd like to move House File 790 to pass and be referred to local government operations.
Representative Moe moves House File 790 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Moe to the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. This is an agency bill, Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. Public Facilities Authority provides grants, actually it's the state grant agency for many of the wastewater treatment programs we have, Clean Water Legacy. They do grants for phosphorus reduction, wastewater treatment, PMDLs, all sorts of other things that we pass through this committee. We need actually an entity that's going to facilitate those grants and make that stuff happen. Public Facilities Authority does that. It's a critical arm of state government helping out local municipalities to do the things we want them to do. I'm not an expert on the agency, however, but we do have the executive director of the agency here, Terry Coleman, who's going to speak to the bill and probably answer most of your questions. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Terry.
Thank you. You state your name for the tape, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Terry Coleman. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. I do have a one-page summary if you want to have that passed out. It's fairly easy to follow. A lot of the changes here are really minor and technical, but there are some technical changes that make some modifications in how we do business, or at least clarify how we do business, and then change some of the programs to make them a little easier to administer. So with that, Mr. Chair, I can give some highlights, or if you want me to go page by page and identify the more significant changes, I can do that.
I think the highlights would be fine unless members want to hear otherwise.
Okay. One of the very first changes, and that's on starting on bottom of page 2 and going on page 3, is really defining the role of the executive director. That section has never been changed in the last... Oh, it is the 20th year anniversary of the PFA, by the way, in the bill. This chapter has been amended every year in those 20 years. A lot has changed in the programs and bonding authority since this paragraph was created. And it really is identifying the executive director as responsible for staff, as well as carrying out issues related to debt issuance that's authorized by the board and responsibilities for state and federal program requirements and tax and security laws and compliance. So that's kind of my role, just kind of defined in law. Some minor administrative things like the bylaws and statute, we've deleted those. We no longer use bylaws, everything is either by rule or that how the authority operates. Most of the changes are fairly technical until you get into page 5, where you get financial feasibility review. We expanded that section a little bit because it was very limited in scope, whether or not total project financing was in place and whether or not an entity could afford to repay the loan. Several other things we need to also look at, so we added those. My board also wanted the ability to vote no occasionally, and projects just don't make sense. So I tried to come up with a test on how to do that, and I think we've been fairly successful to do that. But we also not only look at the very first two things, whether total financing is in place and whether they can afford it, to repay the amount afforded, but do they have the ability to repay? We also look at whether or not it's an eligible use of money, because there's some things you cannot do with bond proceeds. There's some things you can do with state money that you can't do with federal funds. So there's a different combination of things that are possible and eligible depending on the source of money. We also look at compliance with state and federal tax laws, which occasionally come into play on some of these projects and private activity things. So we need to keep those in mind. And as far as coming up with a test, we didn't want necessarily authority to be arbitrary and capricious when making decisions. So we looked at what are the key criteria for judicial review under contested case hearing, and really put that in paragraph B of subdivision 3 on page 5. So it's a pretty stiff standard to reject projects, but when things really don't make sense, you can justify why you don't want to do it. That is in place. The next significant change gets involved in the Water Pollution Control Revolving Fund, is pretty much deleting old language there and kind of modifying items. Trying to think down on page 7, we've deleted reference to what the reference we're deleting is the Small Cities Development Program. We gave them money 1 year to complement federal grant funds to see if they do septics, part of the housing rehab program that they do, and that didn't prove to be very successful. We're keeping in the tourism grant program and the other citations and subdivision 8, number 4, relates to the Agricultural Best Management Practices Program and PCA Clean Water Partnership Loan Program. So that those are the non-point programs there, but we're just taking the one away that we haven't used. The Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program is pretty much housekeeping items, except for one item that came up in discussion now that we have several grant programs, is whether, because when we're not matching USDA federal funds, that program is designed so when a community that's using our normal revolving loan program, if once they hit 5% of market value as far as debt service goes, we can use WIF to continue out with it. And that's a 0% loan that's deferred for 20 years until the state revolving loan fund is paid off, and then they start repaying the loan on the WIF. And one of the questions raised was, will the grant money, if they're eligible for the grant money, will that reduce the loan to the state revolving fund, or does that reduce the WIF assistance? And to make it consistent with another statute, it's really trying to reduce the amount of WIF funds if there's other grants involved. So we just clarified that on line 10.9 on page 10. Otherwise, the rest are pretty standard changes, identifying eligible recipients. Get into total daily maximum load grant program starting on page 12. On line 12.15, we put a cap of $3 million on it because there was no cap in this program. And that was a change that was agreed to by the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, which lobbied for this program 2 years ago and got in the bonding bill. last year, and we talked to them again this summer, and they agreed that the cap is there. We just kind of missed the deadline in conference committee to get it in the bill. The other change is on the bottom, beginning on Project Priority Subdivision 3, where we changed the priority to follow MPCA's project priority list. The current law says we will fund projects based on when EPA approves a TMDL plan, a total daily maximum load plan. Well, the very first plan is approved by EPA has over 200 local units of government that cover that area of the watershed. So we have, in essence, if we don't change the law, have 200 number one priority projects, and I think there's close to 100 on the second TMDL local units of government that would be eligible. So all parties agreed that really following MPCA's project priority list as far as going forward and future makes sense when it comes to reimbursing projects, because this program can go back to March of 2000, because that's when the phosphorus strategy that MPCA developed was started. And with this, oh, I'm sorry, this is the wrong program. We don't reimburse on this one. That's the next one. So that's really the most significant change there. Next one, the Clean Water Phosphorus Reduction Program, starting on page 13. Again, we went with the project priority list, but here, since we can go back and reimburse projects beginning in March of 2000, it was when the facility plan was approved, and going back and looking at all the projects that have been approved since March 2000 and required to address the phosphorus limit, we found many of them did not have facility plans that covered phosphorus. They were, when the permit came up, they just went ahead and did plan specifications. So we're changing the facility plans to when plans and specs were approved for the project. So that's really the only significant change there on that program, other than the, well, there's one other too. We put a cap of $500,000, made that permanent. That was a cap in the program in the bonding bill. Part of the writer language is putting that into the actual statute. The next program, the Small Community Wastewater Assistant or Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program, which is really designed for the communities that have that are underneath PCA's permit requirements. You're talking the two communities that we're working with now. I think one has 16 households, another has 18. I forget how many the third has. But we're talking relatively small ones. We had a lot of interest when we ran an application cycle this summer in June, but we only had three applicants that submit because they were the three that were ready to go. They knew what the solution was to the problem because they've been working on it. The others that had called and inquired, they really don't know what the solution is. So we decided what really needed there is to provide some upfront money in grant form, because we're talking real small entities without financial capability, to take a look and see what's needed. So we're just working with a couple of the people that work with the, these small communities out in the field, plus the 9-point organizations, PCA, Ag Extension, recommended a $10,000 grant up front plus $500 per household so they can do the soil borings to check whether or not septics are a viable option or if we need to go to other centralized assistance. So that's a fairly significant change. There was a technical assistance component built into this program, but it was for designed for after the fact, you know, how to operate and maintain it, how to develop user fees to pay off the debt and schedule maintenances and things like that. But still the eligible component, but emphasis now is up front. And that is also in the, one of the governor's recommendations in this budget for the PFA. Is the first time ever we've asked for general fund money, put in $100,000 a year general fund money for that to make technical assistance grants. So 100% of that money will go to communities to hire the expertise needed to figure out what solutions are. Other than that, I would say that the only other significant changes in the bill, other than real technical in nature, are in the last page when we get into I'll take that back. In the Transportation Revolving Loan Fund, we decided to do away with the Transportation Finance Committee. That was the committee that approved projects. It was the three members of the six members of the board, and it got to be real confusing. Commissioner of Finance, Commissioner of Deed, and Commissioner of Transportation would review and approve projects, but they didn't have the authority to sell bonds, so then you'd bring the projects to the full board after they're approved and authorize the bond sale. So after several years of doing that, we decided to simplify it and just have the board authorize the sale of bonds when we approve projects and make it a one-step process. Otherwise, you get into the last two pages of the bill, where Article 2, we are making a recommended by PCA making changes in the project priority system, since we're tying all the new wastewater programs into that project priority system. And looking at the TMDLs that are being done, one of the issues that arose is where stormwater projects rank. And now that they're doing TMDLs, realizing that stormwater has a major significance in water quality, and they wanted to increase the points to that so that at least stormwater would get up into the fundable range when it's related to a TMDL or an impairment of water that's been identified in a total daily maximum load study. So, and this is the language they came up with on starting with B. We've sunset it to June 30th of 2012. PSA thought they needed anywhere from 5 to 7 years to really get a good handle on stormwater and develop rules that are fairly comprehensive in nature to be able to incorporate it. What it really does is add 10 points if they do have a plan to deal with stormwater and it's related to a TMDL, and then up to a maximum of 10 points depending on the impervious surface, which has an impact on the amount of stormwater that actually flows. So those are the significant changes of the bills. I don't think there's anything controversial. We've worked with all municipal groups on this. They're the affected clients. But there's a downside, but every time you throw in stormwater, there's a little less money for wastewater. But if you're looking at water quality, which this program is supposed to address, we need to be looking at those issues as well. And it's a relatively new issue, and hopefully over the next several years we'll understand stormwater a lot more than we do now, and rules can be drafted in such a way to make a lot more sense. But this kind of plugs the gap between now and then.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kuhlman. Are there any questions at all? Representative Lagunias.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to the stormwater, and if you are somebody who's responsible and you're working on your stormwater, but you are not involved in a putting water into a water body that is impaired, but you're just trying to keep a water body clean that is already clean, or keeping it from getting polluted, it seems to me that puts you at a disadvantage under this procedure. Am I right about that?
Mr. Goldman.
Chair, Representative Wagenius. We did change the priority rating for stormwater. I'm saying we as really the Pollution Control Agency when they modified their rules. If it's a real sensitive body of water, they can get ranked up high enough, like trout streams and high-quality water, to get in the fundable range. But there's a lot of water bodies that aren't necessarily meet that classification or that standard, and the stormwater has to be addressed with TMDLs. So that's why they added points. But historically, before the PSA adopted new rules that went into effect last March, stormwater just got 1 point on the project priority list. So it'd be listed, but it was never high enough to be considered for funding. Now I think that you can get up to 37 or 47 points, depending on the impact stormwater has on water without the TMDLs. And TMDLs just adds more points to it. But stormwater has always been at a disadvantage compared to wastewater. But I think it's slowly getting there.
Representative Lagunias.
I'm looking at a little bit of a different issue. It's just looking at two communities for dealing with stormwater. One community is putting their stormwater into a body of water that is already dirty, and one is putting the stormwater into a body of water that is clean, and they're trying to keep it clean. It seems to me that we're giving priority to cleaning up, and prevention is put at a disadvantage. Let me put it that way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I'm probably not the best person to ask because I'm not the expert in stormwater. I deal with the priority list once it's given. I don't know if anybody at Pollution Control Agency staff would be able to better respond to it, but I'm not quite sure if that's the case with the new rules.
Waltman, please state your name, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Bill Dunham. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And we have recently revised our rule, and this provision applies to both wastewater and stormwater projects. And that being the case, that GMDLs are developed in a process, and we wanted to help to prioritize the limited dollars that we have to those that have been identified in GMDL. That doesn't necessarily mean that a project that is a preventative in nature, not restoration, would not rank high enough. It depends on a number of factors.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Well, let me use Representative Moe's community as an example, where they have a really good wastewater treatment system for Lake Bemidji. So it probably isn't on a TMDL list and won't be, because they have a really high quality system. And they want to do something with their stormwater. But that body of water isn't on the TMDL list. It seems to me that this community would be at a disadvantage, and we are putting prevention on the back burner, and I'm not totally sure that's fair.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Guineas, the way in which the scoring system works, and we can present this in great detail, is that there are points awarded if your body of water is listed as impaired, and then later on there are priority points that are provided if you're actually mentioned within a TMDL where that project is identified. So there are different ways in which you can earn points. And so once again, there's a priority in this system to the impaired waters, but also our highest waters, our ORVWs, where they will receive priority points as well. But again, this is a priority system. There's more demand than there is dollars, and so there has to be a cut somewhere. And in this case, the priority was to give more points to projects identified in the TMDL.
Okay, thank you. And just a reminder, we do have three other bills yet today, and for two of them, we had people coming in from outstate Minnesota, so we'd like to get to those as well. So if we could try to keep the responses and questions to a minimum. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Coleman. I just wanted to clarify one piece, and forgive me if I had stepped out when you were talking about this, but page 16, subdivision 2, actually 16.7, and 16.6 and 7. I just wanted to clarify what was qualifying. Projects to replace non-complying ISTS systems with an individual sewage treatment system or systems, does that include clusters as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Coleman.
Section 5.55 is really a small system, which is community mild system, as well as that.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm sorry if I had missed that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Representative Moe.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I renew my motion. Pass House File 790 and refer to government operations.
Representative Moe renews his motion that House File 790 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed on to Government Operations. Okay. Well, next we're going to take, as you notice, we're taking the bills a little bit out of order here. The next on the agenda, we're going to have Representative Clark presenting her bill, House File 934.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe someone would move the bill. And I do have an amendment that I would like to have added so it could be in the order that...
Representative Clark, I'll move House File 934 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Okay.
And you have an amendment as well. And I will also move Amendment 0934A1. And Representative Clark to the...
Just to the amendment, that's language that was recommended to us by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I can go through that when we talk about the bill.
Okay. And I renew the motion that amendment 0934A1 be passed. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Clark, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll be going through the bill just very briefly because I do want to have some testimony from folks about the bill and its development and some of the issues in more depth. Let me just say that, first of all, this bill is about protecting the public health from toxic flame retardants, polybrominated diphenyl ethers, or PBDEs, as sometimes the way we talk about them. And basically what those are commercial flame retardants that are used in TVs, computers, and some textiles. And they've been widely used over the years, and we now know what we didn't previously know, which is that they are hazardous to our health, and there are safer alternatives. And those safer alternatives are available at a comparable cost. You'll hear a testimony that the American Public Health Association, Minnesota Public Health Association, Minnesota Medical Association have all recommended the phase-out that this bill proposes. And let me just say that what we know about hazards to our health from these products, and I'm going to be very brief because you'll hear more, is just that they are developmental toxins, and children are especially at risk. They're toxic to the brain, the reproductive system, the liver, thyroid. And another group of people that are really at risk are firefighters who, when these products are being burned, release very dangerous, toxic byproducts. So I'll just briefly go through the bill. To point out, first of all, there's a definition section that does explain that we're phasing out the penta and the octa type of flame retardants here. And let me just point out to you that 8 states have already phased those out. There's not a national ban on them, but it's just not being made anymore. And for the most part, we have very few manufacturers. I think only one in Minnesota that actually uses that. The DECA type, however, is still somewhat in use, and so this bill would say that by January of 2010, we would not allow manufacturers in Minnesota to do that anymore, to use this type of flame retardant in their products. And we would be joining 6 other states that are considering that right now: Hawaii, Maine, Washington, Illinois, Montana, and California. They're all looking at this, at phasing out the DECA portion right now. There are exemptions in this bill. They're exempting certain products, used transportation vehicles, vehicles used primarily for military or federally funded space programs, the sale of any used products, new carpet cushions that are made from recycled foam, medical devices. And we do say that in-state retailers who have stock on hand are allowed to exhaust them as of January 1, 2008. We give the commissioner some duties to look at the availability of alternatives and look at the potential health and environmental effects and report that back to us so that we keep abreast of what's going on. And we ask that, that they make recommendations to the legislature every 2 years. We also ask the commissioner to participate in a regional and national clearinghouse to keep up to date on what's going on with these issues, and require the commissioner administration to have the products that are available for purchase by state agencies be limited to these kinds of products that are phased out, that are not phased out unless they're exempted in the bill earlier. The exemptions, we do allow manufacturers to receive temporary exemptions if it's not technically feasible to do an alternative, use an alternative in their production right now, and if they can show that it doesn't pose greater risk of harm. We also allow the commissioner to reward our manufacturers who do a good job of this with PBDE free labeling to the products, and there's a fee that's accompanies that exemption that is used to pay for the cost of the program. And finally, there is a penalty, civil penalty, for violation of the provision. Mr. Chair, with that, I just want to ask Kathleen Schuler from the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy to take us through a more in-depth presentation.
Thank you. And Ms. Schuler, if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Yes, my name is Kathleen Schuler, and I'm with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. I'm a senior policy analyst and a public health scientist. IATP is a nonprofit organization based in Minneapolis. It'll just take me 1 minute to cue this up here.
Members, you all should also have a little packet that has a number of pretty good information in you can check out.
Yes, you should have received a packet with a fact sheet that we developed at IATP with two fact sheets that were developed by Clean Production Action, which is associated with the Lowell Center for Sustainability at the University of Massachusetts on DECA fire safety and DECA and also DECA alternatives in electronics. We also have the executive summary from a couple of reports. Both Maine and Washington, their Department of Ecology and Department of Environmental Protection did a thorough review of the literature on DECA and have issued reports, which we actually have the full reports, which I gave to Kirk if you want to see those, but you have the executive summaries in your packets. We also have the resolutions from the health and public health organizations. So I'm just going to give a little background on, this is kind of a complex issue, but we want you to understand it. Obviously, flame retardants are very important, and they play a very useful role in fire protection. They slow the spread of a fire. They prevent fires. The problem is some of the flame retardants that are used, as Representative Clark mentioned, are creating environmental and public health problems. And these are the polybrominated diphenyl ethers, or PBDEs. These chemicals are very much like PCBs, which were banned in the 1970s because of their persistence and bioaccumulativeness and the fact that they are toxic and cause developmental problems in children. And we have extensive studies on PCBs. PCBs, even though they were banned, are still found in our environment. They're still found in breast milk. They're still found in fish. The levels are going down, though. Unfortunately, with the flame retardants, the levels are going up. These chemicals accumulate in fat. They're globally transported. They bind to particles, so they can accumulate in sediments, and that's how they can build up in the fish. They're neurotoxic, and the pollution problem is growing. There are less toxic alternatives available, which I'll talk about, and regulation is necessary to protect public health and the environment. There's widespread exposure to these PCBs. The levels in U.S. women's breast milk is 10 to 100 times the level in European women because some of these chemicals are regulated in Europe. And they have been phased out. So the levels in Europe are starting to go down, and I'll show you that. Total PBDE levels in breast milk, blood, and tissues have increased 100-fold during the past 30 years, doubling every 4 years. So when you look at this, this is really, you know, an astounding rate of increase and an astounding public health problem. Levels in Minnesota fish sediments, sewage sludge, and wastewater are increasing. And we have a copy of a report that the Pollution Control Agency in Minnesota here did in 2005, which we can share with you. And they acknowledge that DECA is a problem, that brominated flame retardants and DECA in particular is a problem. This is just, if you look at the, on the left, the line on the left shows that PCBs are going down in the environment. The line on the right that goes up and then down, those are the brominated flame retardants. And this is from a breast milk program in Sweden. They actually monitor contaminants in breast milk. And when Sweden found that this was going up, they worked with the companies to phase them out, and they're also regulated, so the levels started going down. And it shows the power of regulation. Polybrominated diphenyl ethers, there's three commercial mixtures, and it's important to understand those because we're regulating those differently. Penta was widely used in polyurethane foam, so many of us probably have it in our houses. Octa was used in plastic housings. The DECA is still used. Penta and Octa used to be made by Chemtura, which is a U.S. company. They have phased them out beginning in 2005. So new products sold in the U.S. will not have Penta and Octa. They're also banned in Europe. DECA is still widely used. It's used in plastic TV enclosures most commonly. It's used in wire and cable applications. And some textiles, mostly those used more in institutional settings like theaters and nursing homes, public places, not so much in the home. I mentioned that the Penta and the Octa are phased out. However, DECA is still widely used. In 2001, it's estimated that over 24,000 metric tons were used. Penta and Okta, we have a lot of data on Penta and Okta to show that they are toxic and bioaccumulative. And they are building up in the environment and in living things. And in the last 5 years, we also have data on DECA, and I'm going to talk about some of that. DECA is considered less toxic because it's a larger molecule, and it isn't as easily absorbed by the human body and by living things. But we're finding that it's still a problem. 200 studies conducted around the world show that DECA is being found in the environment, in marine and freshwater sediments, in air samples in the Arctic, in fish, meat, and dairy products, which we all consume, in sewage sludge, and in wildlife, particularly bears, birds, and orchids. It's also found in household dust. So when it's used in a television, it gets into the household dust. It's not chemically bound to the plastic. It can get released into the dust and expose us, and especially expose children. It's found in human blood and breast milk. And the fact sheet that you have that we developed has references for this, so there are studies on this. We're not just making this up. DECA BDE degrades into more toxic byproducts. I mentioned that Penta and Okta are more toxic. The problem is DECA's out there, and DECA's toxic, but it's less toxic than the others. The problem is it does debrominate. It degrades into the more toxic forms. And there are 21 studies showing that DECA breaks down to the lower brominated compounds when exposed to sunlight. And 7 of these mimic the actual environmental conditions. So we're not just forcing this in a laboratory. They mimic the conditions that are out there in real life. Breakdown has been demonstrated in fish, in sediments, and in sewage sludge. 4 studies found the Penta and the Okta as breakdown products. And these are known persistent bioaccumulative toxins that are banned in Europe and in 8 states. We are widely exposed to DECA. One study found DECA in the breast milk of 24 of 40 women studied. It's been found in cord blood of newborn babies. And an estimated 5% of American women have levels of total PBDEs in their body greater than the levels that have been shown to cause reproductive problems in laboratory animals. The problem with the PBDEs is we don't have human data. We don't have these epidemiological studies that we have with PCBs, but we have animal studies that are very compelling. The risk to infants, fetuses, and children are the greatest because PBDEs cross the placenta. Infants and children are more susceptible to toxins because the blood-brain barrier is not fully developed. The intestinal absorption is greater in young children, and we know this from lead. The skin is more permeable. Kids put their fingers in their mouths. They're crawling close to the ground, so they're absorbing more dust. They're breathing in more dust. And they also receive these toxins through breast milk. It's estimated that kids can receive up to 300 times greater exposure to DECA than adults, primarily from household dust and breast milk. This is the animal research that we have on DECA in adult mice that were exposed to DECA. It produced irreversible changes in brain function that worsened with age. So these weren't things that went away. They were effects that lasted. DECA was absorbed in neonatal mice, and levels in the brain continued to increase in mice exposed only once, suggesting a targeting of the brain or increased uptake. And then 10 to 65% of DECA was absorbed from the diet of lab rats. In the European Union, they have banned PBDEs in textiles with dermal contact. By the way, brominated flame retardants are not in children's pajamas. People ask that the first thing. Are these the chemicals that are in children's pajamas? They are not in clothing. The European Union prohibits Okta and Penta. We mentioned that. There was a ban on DECA, but it was delayed until 2010. Sweden prohibits DECA use in textiles. And then finally, DECA is prohibited in Europe, in electronics in Europe, because of contamination with a lower brominated product that is Nona BDE. So that would have 9 bromine molecules. It's more toxic because it's a lower brominated compound. So DECA itself is not yet prohibited, but it's prohibited because it is contaminated with a banned substance. There are alternatives available. The National Electronic Manufacturers Association sets flame retardant standards, and there are numerous alternatives that meet the Underwriters Laboratory UL 94 standard. There are various approaches to reducing the use of toxic flame retardants. There's a physical separation of the heat-producing elements in the product. There's the use of naturally flame-retardant materials, such as self-extinguishing plastics, and those exist, and then other halogen-free chemicals. The brominated flame retardants are halogens. They're considered more toxic. One alternative that's being used by electronic manufacturers and as an alternative to DECA is RDP, resorcinol bisdiphenyl phosphate, or RDP. This is a phosphorus-based flame retardant. It meets the Underwriters Laboratory fire safety standards for television components. It's not persistent or bioaccumulative. And the Maine Department of Environmental Protection, I mentioned they had done a thorough study of the literature, states that RDP presents a significantly lower threat to the environment and human health than DECA BDE. There are also alternatives for textiles. There are inherently flame-resistant fabrics, and Stearns & Foster produced this FlameGuard mattress. It does not contain brominated flame retardants, but the natural fabrics, they add something that makes it sort of the fabric mush together when there's a flame so that it doesn't go up in flame. It just sort of melts. They have barrier layers, and they're also safe for flame retardants. There are many electronic companies that are already phasing these out, partially because they are phased out in Europe, and partially because there are companies that really have this environmental ethic that they want to phase these toxic flame retardants out. Here's an example: Apple, Ericsson, IBM, Intel, Motorola. The list goes on of companies that are phasing these out. Motorola uses halogen-free laminate, and Toshiba replaced their BFR plastic casing with polyphenylene sulfide. Sony states that all of their virgin plastics presently used are DECA-free, and they meet all relevant fire safety standards. We have support for this phase-out by mainstream health and public health organizations, including the American Public Health Association, the Minnesota Public Health Association, the Minnesota Medical Association, the Minnesota Nurses Association, the Learning Disability Association, ARC Greater Twin Cities, and 10 environmental organizations. We do not alter the fire safety standards with this bill. The fire safety standards remain as they are. It phases out DECA in electronic enclosures, that is, televisions and computers, and textiles for home use and mattresses. The uses that are not regulated, textiles that are used in institutional settings, wire and cable, and most transportation uses. This is not a choice between protecting the public from fire and protecting the public from toxic flame retardants. Assuring fire safety is a given. We just need to use the safer alternatives. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shuler. And I don't know if there's any questions before we move on to the next testifiers. Okay, seeing none, then Ms. Ledwidge.
Hi.
Hi, and if you could state your name, please.
It's Lisa Ledwidge. I live in Minneapolis. I work there. I live and work in my home. I'm 20 weeks pregnant with my first child. And, you know, there's something that happens with parents and parents-to-be that you just kind of, something, maybe it's intrinsic or something, but you all of a sudden do everything that you can to protect your baby and the baby that might be in your womb. And that's what brings me here today. Parents and parents-to-be should not have to worry that neurotoxic flame retardants might leach out of their household electronics and end up in their baby's umbilical cord, blood, and in their breast milk. it's wrong that children are born with this toxic burden, especially when there are safer alternatives. I try to eat organic food. I clean my house with vinegar in much of the places so I can avoid the synthetic chemicals. I try to watch the fish that I eat to avoid mercury and PCBs, but right now I can't buy a TV that's going to keep my family safe from these toxins that are in the flame retardants. I'm also powerless to protect the fetus that's now in my womb from this threat. So I'm asking for your help in fixing this problem by supporting the bill that's before you. And I imagine that the mothers that I know and fathers that I know and the parents-to-be, if they were aware of this problem, that they would also be asking you for the same thing. I'm as concerned about the next person, about my electronic devices catching fire, but when there are safer alternatives, then the state has a responsibility to act for public health. The government phased out lead and PCBs 30 or so years ago because of its effects on children's health, and so I hope that Minnesota will be proud to be a leader in phasing out this new toxic threat to protect children's health in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ledwidge. And we have next Ms. Fondell.
Good afternoon. My name is Beth Fondell, and I'm here today representing ARC Greater Twin Cities, which is an advocacy organization with a 60-year history of supporting children, adults, and families who are impacted by an intellectual or a related developmental disability. Over the past two decades, we have seen at ARC that there has been a sharp increase in children being diagnosed with lifelong developmental disorders, such as autism, attention deficit, hyperactive disorders, speech-language delays, and other metabolic-related syndromes. In relationship to autism specifically, during the 1980s, one case in 10,000 births was evidenced. In the 1990s, one in 500 births. And the most recent statistic, which actually just came out about a month ago from the Center for Disease Control, has indicated one in 150 births. Something is amiss with these kids. This diagnostic timeline does correlate with the increased use of toxic chemicals like PVDE in flame retardants, mercury in vaccines, lead in paint, and formerly PCBs and pesticides as part of our day-to-day lives. Is it not probable that the same chemical exposure that paralyzes and kills insects and weeds could also paralyze the development of a human being when they're exposed? The research is becoming increasingly compelling in support of more than just a casual relationship between chemical exposure and developmental disorders. As with any chemical, there is always going to be a subgroup of individuals more vulnerable to the impact of exposure. And these are the children that we are daily attempting to orchestrate a menu of support services for on a regular basis. There is genetic predisposition to a developmental disability that has always been a variable in infant brain development. However, chemical exposure appears to be attributing to the rising numbers of children that are being diagnosed. And subsequently, the demand for our services is continuing to increase as we try to put together long-term supports for these same children and their families to simply participate in activities of daily living. We have the ability to exercise control over the widespread use of toxic chemicals in our home and community environments, as well as access to safer alternatives, as Kathleen just described. So on behalf of the 212,000 Minnesotans who are affiliated with our Greater Twin Cities, primarily because of their concern for preventing developmental disabilities in the future, I am asking you today to support this House File number 934, and I really do appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about this critical issue. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fondell. And next on the agenda, we have Ms. Heitzman. Is she with us? Registered nurse. Okay. We have heard from the testimony from those who are in support of the bill. There are two who would like to testify in opposition as well. And first on the list we have Ms. Ruiz? Yes. Yes, Representative Poppy.
Well, we're getting set up with this tea time, and I'm not sure who my question's for, the author or somebody, but I ask this question a lot, and when I look at page 10 of the slides that we had, I'm just wondering if this legislation is necessary. If private companies are already phasing this out and doing this, I mean, do we need to do this bill?
Anyone want to field that question? Ms. Schuler?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the TVs sold in Europe do not have DECA. TVs sold in the U.S. are still permitted to have DECA. So it's still a risk. So this legislation is necessary to protect us from this exposure in our own homes from televisions and other kinds of equipment. We put the textiles and the mattresses in to prevent future uses of DECA. We don't want it used in our mattress where we sleep and get exposed every day.
Okay. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not a scientist or anything. Everybody knows that. if they're phasing it out in Europe, why don't the same companies phase it out here?
Ms. Schuler.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, regulation drives companies. It's not the only driving source, but if the TVs in Europe do not have DECA, it's because it's regulated in Europe, and it's not here, and it needs to be.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Okay, if not, Ms. Ruiz, welcome and state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura Ruiz, and I'm here today representing the Bromine Science and Environmental Forum, and I thank you for this opportunity to address the committee today. I want to express some concerns about some of the provisions included in the House File 934. The issue I think that we are here to address today is how we balance safety, and we've heard a lot about safety from the previous speakers. And in this case, I think the safety issues that we are concerned about are those related to risks and consequences from fire versus those that are either potential or perceived from human or environmental exposure. And I would say that the key to looking at this issue is to assess the risk involved and to make sure that that risk is well balanced. I think it's important to look at the reason these products are contained in so many applications and end uses, and that reason is primarily to protect the public. And if you look at the facts, I think they speak for themselves. In the U.S., we still have a very real threat of fire and harm and damage from fire. In the U.S. alone, nearly 4,000 civilians are killed each year, 117 firefighters. In Minnesota, on an annual basis, 40 civilians are killed each year from fire, 148 civilian, 382 firefighter injuries, and almost a half a million or $439,000 each day in property loss. So what flame retardants are able to do is improve the safety levels for the public to either prevent or to slow the spread of fire, and most importantly, increase escape time up to 15 times. They also provide a safety level for our firefighters. It allows them more time to respond to the fire and reduces that fire intensity. The picture depicted on the right hand of the slide is what happens in a full front room fire containing upholstered furniture, textiles, carpet, electronics after 3 minutes. You can see the situation is extremely dangerous. If flame retardants are in products contained in these rooms, again, you allow more time for escape. We're here today to address a class of flame retardants known as PBDEs, all of which are distinctly different from one another. The product that I would like to talk to you about today primarily is DECA, decabrome as we call it, and it has wide applicability in a variety of end uses. And the reason is that it is extremely compatible with a number of the resin systems that go into these end uses. You'll hear about electronic enclosures like TVs and other parts containing DECA, as well as textile back coatings, but also appliances, automotive, switches, adhesives, and various other end-use applications. What you often hear about this product is that it is one of the highest volume commercial flame retardants used today. And that is true. Again, because of its wide applicability to a variety of end uses, its compatibility, and its ease of use, it has become an extremely popular product and has been in use for over 30 years. You will also hear very often that there are reported findings of this class, PBDEs, which are often misrepresented as DECA findings in the environment. And I would caution that you need to be very careful how those findings are expressed. This happens quite often where PBDE findings are equated with the DECA, overstating the amount of DECA. You will hear that DECA can be found in the environment, and as with many chemicals, this is true. The important thing to note here is the level that it is found and the risk that that level equates to. You will also hear that DECA can degrade to more toxic forms in the environment, such as some of the other PBDEs we've heard about today, Penta and Octa. And this is false. I'll give you more information about that. You will hear, as you have, that the EU has already restricted use of DECA in electronics. This is also not true. And finally, you will hear companies have found safer substitutes to DECA. And I will offer my definition of safer and ask you that question, whether or not companies truly have found safer substitutes to DECA. What you won't likely hear is that DECA is a proven and cost-effective flame retardant. It's very easy and safe to handle. It is in the form of a white powder. The users, as I mentioned, have over 30-plus years of experience with this product. The alternatives such as RDP that you've heard about today and some of the other PBDEs are liquid forms of flame retardants, so it requires a different type of handling process. This product is highly effective, meaning you can use less. And its cost-effectiveness and wide availability have actually enabled us to drive fire safety into applications where it is not regulated. In other words, voluntary safety standards have been allowed to expand worldwide because of the availability of this cost-effective flame retardant to use. This product, Decabrome, is also stable. Others will call it persistent and create a negative image of that characteristic. But persistent means that it stays in the product as a long-lived component of fire safety, which is what I think we all want to see. Certainly firefighters going into a fire to put out a piece of equipment that's 10-plus years old would like to think that that equipment still has an effective flame retardant.
Excuse me, we have a couple of questions. So, yes. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Ruiz, is that correct?
Ruiz, yes.
Yeah, thank you. We have a couple blatant inconsistencies here, and I wonder, maybe you said that these haven't been limited in Europe whatsoever. I think we've heard testimony to the contrary, so we have differing information for the committee here. And the other is that there are not cost-effective alternatives or safer alternatives available. I think maybe you could clarify those or just restate those, and then if we could have maybe Ms. Schuler or the author speak to that again, I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
Representative, I do have further information that addresses both of those questions in the presentation. If you'd like me to answer them now, though, I will.
Well, we can continue forward. And one question that I had in relation to this, as far as talking about the European Union and the fact, is it a fact that there has been that they are not using, or there's been a significant reduction in the use of DECA in Europe?
Mr. Chairman, in terms of the use of DECA in Europe, DECA went through a 10-year risk assessment looking at its impact to human health and the environment, and at the end of 2004, it was found to have no significant risks in either area, human health or in the environment. And so no risk reduction measures were put on the product, and it was continued to be recommended for use. As a result of those conclusions of the EU risk assessment, there are no restrictions for use in the EU for Decabrome, and it continues to be used. It was a product that was mentioned in one of the directives, the Restriction on Hazardous Substances Directive, but it has been exempted from that directive, so it can continue to be used in Europe.
Okay. And maybe we could have just a response, if we could, before moving on.
Whether it's being used or not being used.
Right. So Ms. Okay. Go ahead, Ms. Schuler.
DECA was exempted from the Ross Agreement, as you mentioned, until 2010. But recently, there was a determination that because it's contaminated with NONA, the lower brominated form of chemical that's already banned, that it is not allowed in electrical equipment in Europe. This is a very recent ruling within the last few months.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
yes, Ms. Ruiz.
May I explain further? There is a non-binding opinion that the product that went through the risk assessment was free of any impurities, which was simply not the case. The product that went through 10 years of testing was a commercial product that was widely used in the marketplace, and that product was found to be free of risk. And so that is a point, an issue that is still non-binding. So in absence of a different decision by the EU, the original exemption still holds.
And Representative Hoppe, you had a question?
Well, I don't know if this is the right place for it, but I don't know if that's true. Then when we're looking at all these companies that are phasing this out, are they, let me ask it this way. When you look at the next slide, underneath all the companies that are phasing it out, and it's saying that Sony is DECA-free in the United States, I assume in the United States and Europe, if companies are doing this already, if it's cost-effective and makes sense, do we need this regulation? And Ms. Schuler said we had to have regulation to get businesses to do this, but if Sony's doing it without regulation, I go back to my original question, is this necessary? I want to make things as safe as we can, too. I just don't know if we need legislation to do it.
To this point, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Ruiz, would you like to respond, and then Ms. Schuler, and then...
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative. The pressure that has created the market making statements, public statements and policy that they are moving away from certain flame retardants, such as DECA, is created by the pressure put on their brand name, which, as you know, is an extremely valuable product, and not because they believe that there are problems with the toxicity profile or the environmental or the human health aspects of this product.
Okay. And Ms. Schuler, would you want to respond as well?
Mr. Chair, I just would reiterate that not all the companies are phasing out DECA. Some of them are, and so we need regulation to capture those that are not phasing it out.
Okay. And Representative Moe.
I'm sorry, the author, I think, had a...
Oh, Representative Clark.
Well, Mr. Chair, the other thing is I think if you look at the bill, it provides an incentive as well for companies to phase out. So it's not just regulation against. It's also encouraging, letting the consumer know when there are PBD-free products, and that'll be an incentive.
Yeah. And Representative Moe?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And this seems strange to me that Mr. Ruiz is implying that this stuff, there's no toxicity whatsoever. This is, why I don't understand why all these companies are phasing it out. Is it purely for public relations purposes? I mean, it seems rather odd to me that they would be that preventative. Maybe you could explain that. That seems a little preemptive.
Mr. Chair, yes, there have been moves afoot to remove certain chemicals from the marketplace by environmental activist groups for quite some time. And if you'll see some of the actions by groups like Greenpeace to put a scorecard together for electronic manufacturers and then rate those who continue to use certain types of products such as PVC or phthalates or brominated flame retardants, it creates an enormous amount of pressure for those manufacturers to rewrite policy so that their brand is not highlighted in a negative fashion. It does not necessarily mean that they believe the product is toxic.
Okay. Yeah, Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if we're really debating the science of whether this breaks down or not. I mean, I'm kind of astounded at that comment, and I can just tell you that I have documentation from our own Minnesota Pollution Control Agency that talks about the breakdown of DECA into the just from sunlight into the lower versions of penta and octa. I'd be glad to share that with people, but I also want to say, we're not just talking about Greenpeace, we're talking about the American Public Health Association, the Minnesota Public Health Association, the Minnesota Medical Association, the Minnesota Nurses Association, the Minnesota Learning Disabilities Association, ARC, 10 other environmental organizations. These are organizations that have looked at this and say, this is a hazard that we really can't afford anymore, and we should try to phase it out. And I think what I tried to do with this bill and working with all the folks here is take a very reasonable approach, the phased-out approach. And we say there's a waiver. If you think you can't do this, if a company in Minnesota thinks they can't do this, and they have, they can't work with an alternative, they can get a waiver from the commissioner for 3 years to go through a process and get to that point. So this is a very moderate approach in Minnesota. So if we don't do something, we're just going to keep having more and more products that we continue to have this in.
Okay. You mentioned the pollution control, that they have determined that this does break down. Is there, I don't know if there's anyone here from...
Mr. Chair, could I object to the way the proceeding is going forward right now? It seems to me we should at least have one side present their case as originally happened here, then have the opposing viewpoints presented in its entirety. So then I can have a bigger picture of what the issues really are, rather than trying to do these little piecemeals at a time. I can get easily confused, and I don't like to have this come at me in pieces. I wish I'd have a complete presentation.
Okay. Well, we can proceed with the why don't we do that? I know Representative, maybe two more questions here, Representative Cornish and Representative Hoppe, and then we can continue on.
To that point, I would just, when we do get that far, I would like to sometime bring it back and hit the 2 points you said were false, and we're still missing one because you covered one. And then the other thing is, out of all those organizations that support this, how many did their independent study on their own, formed their own conclusions, or just read that data file and said, oh, yeah, we'll jump on board? That's those two questions when you get to that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would like to address those questions, and I have answers, I believe, in the presentation to do so. I'll just conclude this slide by saying that this product is the most studied flame retardant on the market today, and you'll see that compared with all the alternatives that have been considered by some of these organizations that have been mentioned. It is accepted for continued use not only by the U.S. EPA, but also the Consumer Product Safety Commission, as well as the European Union, where, again, I would like to emphasize it is not restricted for use. I'd like to just pose the following questions. If you're looking at what the definition of a safer alternative means, I'd like for everybody to consider, does that alternative provide equivalent fire protection in the same applications at the same or reduced amounts? Does either the process or the raw materials used to make that alternative create additional concerns that have not been thought through for either the environment or the personnel that are required to handle it? has that alternative gone through an exhaustive and equivalent battery of testing for both human health and environmental effects? And how does that alternative perform at the end of its life during recycle? I will say that that has been exhaustively tested in terms of decabrome and other brominated flame retardants, and they perform extremely well up to 5-6 cycles in recycle. Is there an emissions control program in use for that alternative? In the case of decabrome, there's a voluntary emissions control action program that is currently in use in several countries, looking at the way the product is handled, not only in our manufacturing sites, but also by our customers and downstream users, the goal of which is to eliminate emissions from ever getting into the environment, where I've mentioned already we know they are, and to eliminate those products from getting into humans. Here is a comparison of all the studies that have been done on the alternatives, including DECA. DECA, as you can see, is the green bar above. The RDP product that has been mentioned is 7 bars down. Speaking of RDP, since it has already been brought forward, is one alternative that shows that is of interest in some of the studies that have been cited. I will look at 2 very important factors and compare that product with decabrome. The first, in terms of bioconcentration, is a measure of the bioaccumulation or buildup of the product in the environment, and you can see the difference between DECA BDE and RDP. Another concern or criteria that should be considered is toxicity to aquatic life. And you can see that in terms of chronic aquatic toxicity hazard, DECA comes out far below RDP. And I will tell you, if you buy RDP in the European market, it is required to be labeled as an aquatic toxicity hazard. Again, the science shows not only in the EU, with over 588 studies over 10 years, that DECA presents no risk to human health or the environment. They've concluded in the EU that there is no need for further risk reduction measures. And again, I'd like to emphasize there is no restriction on the use of DECA. And there is also continued monitoring in place to make sure that over time we see what the effects and the levels of DECA are doing in the environment, and that those are continuously coming down. I'd like to also talk about additional independent evaluations, which I think are very important. If you look at other independent groups that have looked at DECA from the standpoint of toxicity, bioaccumulation, and degradation, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences reviewed this product in 2000. The Consumer Product Safety Commission reviewed this product in 2001 and 2006. The UK Institute of Occupational Medicine reviewed DECA in 2003. The UK Department of Trade and Industry looked at the product in 2005. In Japan, the product was reviewed in 2005. California State Senate of Office Research reviewed the product in 2005. And the Maryland Department of Environmental Protection reviewed the product as recently as December of 2006. All of these independent bodies conclude DECA is not toxic and it is not a PBT, or a persistent bioaccumulative toxic material. I'd like to look at 2 of the most recent studies and give you the conclusions. In Maryland, the Department of the Environment findings are as follows, and they concur with the actions of the EU and other U.S. states. The DECA should not be banned unless safer alternatives are identified and or new toxicological data shows that there is an unacceptable risk to the public and or the environment. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission reviewed DECA with several other flame retardants before it put forward its national mattress standard last year, and concluded that when studied along these other flame retardants, it does not pose any appreciable risk of health effects to consumers. Again, this is a federal ruling. So I think the body of evidence is clear, the science is clear from very credible and reputable third parties, not just our industry, that there is no appreciable concern over the risk level of DECA in either humans or the environment. Another concern I'd like to bring forward in terms of alternatives, which we haven't talked about today, is that if you look at all the applications where DECA is currently in use, in consumer electronics, home furnishings, automotive, public transportation, and aircraft, there are reasons why it's there. Some of those reasons are mandated in terms of federal or state standards, fire safety standards. Others are voluntary. And again, because DECA works so well and it's so easily handled and it's so effective at very low levels, we have one of the highest fire safety standards in the United States, anywhere in the world, and it's voluntary. The UL standards are not mandated, yet most OEMs in this country put flame retardants in there. If we were to remove one of the most cost-effective and well-proven products from the marketplace, my concern is not the Sonys, not the Panasonics, not the Sharps, but the low-end, low-value manufacturers may not be able to afford to replace Decabrome with a more costly formulation change. And what will happen is they will remove flame retardants altogether, and we are already finding this in the United States. There are Chinese brands that are being sold at places like Walmart that do not have any flame retardants in them. They don't have to put them in there, and they're not. And that's what my concern is going forward if we remove this well-tested product. So in conclusion, I would like to leave you with the following, that chemical flame retardants have a place and they're important in terms of fire prevention. DECA is the most studied flame retardant available for its uses. It does not pose, based on all the conclusive science, does not pose added risk to humans, firefighters, or the environment. Human environmental impacts of alternatives, I think we can say, are unclear at best. There's a lot more testing that needs to be done. And to date, no state anywhere in this country has taken action against the use of Decabrome. So back to the issue of the balance and assessing the risk. With a 30-year track record in use for this product and a proven technology in place for fire safety, I'd ask you to consider the alternatives extremely carefully because they have many, many more unknowns. And ask yourself the question, what additional risks are we bringing forward if we look to ban Decabrome? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ruiz. And Representative Hoppe.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a question maybe for the author or Ms. Schuler. Is that appropriate right now?
We do have one other testifier for opposed to the bill.
Maybe it would be a good question for anybody. We had a whole list of people that are supporting this, but I'm wondering what the firefighters think. Do they have an opinion on this? Is there from the state firefighters or Minneapolis or St. Paul or the fire marshal's office, is there, have they weighed in?
Representative Clark?
Mr. Chairman, I did visit with the fire marshal. We had quite a long discussion about it, and they are not taking a position. They're just neutral.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? As I say, we have one representative, Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Faris, I was listening carefully to your testimony, and I'm learning quickly here. This is brand new for me, but my understanding is that there are three distinct products in this class, Penta, Octa, and Deca for short. It seemed to me your testimony, I think I heard it right, was exclusively focused on Deca products. Can you comment on the Penta and Octa products as well, because that's encapsulated in Representative Pike's bill?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Ruiz.
I would like to answer that question by saying that Penta and Octa have in fact been removed from the market by the only manufacturer of those products, and they are not in use to date. So yes, I was focused on the one product in the class, again, that is distinctly different from the other two because it is a very widely used product still in use in many applications today.
Any other? Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Chairman. My question would be, are we going to hear anything from MPCA? I just have concern we've gotten some substantially different conflicting information, and it would be my thoughts if MPCA can't weigh in on this, I guess I would want to ask the author, have you thought about I'm not a fan of studies, but if we're getting this kind of conflicting information, I think MPCA needs to come back to us with some more information that we can make a better decision.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, if I have the MPCA come back, I have a letter that was sent to me. I had this bill looked at for a couple of years in 2005 in which, you know, the science that the MPCA cites is really, it contradicts the testimony that, you know, again, that there's no breakdown of DECA to the two lower versions. And actually, Representative Mariani, I just say, you know, that is the problem, that there's no question that the other two versions, you know, the Penta and Octa are very hazardous, and they have been banned, and they are not in production for good reason. And when you have a product out there that breaks down to those two products, then you're putting out the very hazardous products. And it, you know, I'd be glad to share my letter from the MPCA, but perhaps, you know, it would be fine to have them come forward to whatever we need to do.
I don't know.
We just have obviously a very, you know, different science here, it looks like.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Ms. Ruiz.
If I could I give you just one more piece of information on this topic of degradation? Because I agree that has been the one area with a lot of difference of opinion. In terms of degradation, if you look at most of the studies that are done on the breakdown of decabrome, they are done in a forced laboratory setting or under conditions that are not likely to be present under normal use. And the fact is that the EU has gone back and reviewed the most recent data from these studies and continues to summarize that the available monitoring data provide little evidence for debromination or degradation occurring in significant quantities in the environment. And further study on DECA continues in this area because, again, it is such a contentious issue. And they're also looking for potential degradation as part of an environmental monitoring program being conducted by the European Union over the next 10 years. And every year, our industry is required to report the findings to the EU. And the results so far since 2004 have shown no significant detection of DECA in the environment. So this work does continue. We're committed to doing more monitoring and testing so that we can continue to show that these levels are being reduced in the environment.
Thank you. And I don't know if there's somebody from the MPCA that would like to step forward and address this issue. Thank you for joining us, and if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Yes, I'm Marvin Horup with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency with the Environmental Outcomes Division.
So, yes, and it's to the issue of the degradation or the breakdown of DECA. If that does occur, there was a question on that issue.
We have a concern with the potential breakdown from DECA. I agree that I think the information available on the lower brominated is pretty set within the scientific communities. The Tetra and the Octa that have toxic effects and are of concern. We haven't done probably the complete study or in-depth look at each of the individual studies that talk about degradation. We know there are studies out there that talk about it and the degradation, and I believe that we are concerned that DECA has the potential to degrade into more toxic problems.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Horgan. Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to raise that another level, and is your concern about the potential degradation as great as your knowledge that these items in the home catch on fire, that lives are at risk?
Mr. Horg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond, I'm a biologist and I deal with toxicology. I'm not really knowledgeable about the ability of products to reduce fire or to start fires or retard fires as a chemical, I can say that, you know, brominated to halogenated compounds are of a concern. Just like PCBs that was indicated earlier, they're long-lived, they have toxic effects. Each of the chemicals does have its own particular impacts, toxicity, persistence. So as a chemical, and just the nature of the chemical being a halogenated material, that is very long-lived. Although it, you know, we do have concerns about the breakdown, I can't really give a risk assessment as to what's more important, the toxicity or the fire retardant capability.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hargett. Any other questions for the PCA since we have them at the table? Thank you very much. And Representative Lagunias, you have a question?
If I could, I just wanted to clarify Ms. Ruiz's testimony. What I thought I heard you say was that DECA doesn't break down in significant quantities. Is that what you said?
No, my comment was that DECA can be forced to break down in certain conditions that are not normal conditions of use. I also mentioned that in the EU, they have continued to look for DECA in the environment in terms of a breakdown or breakdown products of DECA in the environment and have not found any in significant quantities. The products that have been found in the environment, Penta and Octa, are believed to be coming from those products themselves as Penta and Octa and not as breakdown products from Decabrone.
Representative Lagunias.
You did use that term again, insignificant quantities, and of course that is a judgment call, what is significant or not significant. There was testimony that DECA has been found in breast milk. Would you agree that that has happened?
Ms. Ruiz?
Mr. Chair, that Decabrome has been found in breast milk, that is true. It has been found in breast milk. The levels have been 1,000 to 1 million times below the reference dose, which has been assigned to DECA as creating no adverse effects. So very, very small quantities. And again, you have to ask whether the reported findings are being expressed as actual DECA findings or as total PBDE findings, which is often the case.
Okay. Representative Lagunias.
There was testimony that DECA has been identified in the cord blood of newborn babies. Would you agree with that?
Ms. Ruiz.
There is a study, I believe, in 2001, I'm not quite sure, that's been cited where, again, Decabrome was found in cord blood. These levels, again, were well below any kind of level of concern.
Representative Lagunias.
And what part per billion were you talking about? That's a level of concern.
There is a reference dosage that is set forward by the National Academy of Sciences of 4 parts per million.
4 parts per million.
Representative Lagunias.
4 parts per million is a very high dose of any kind of chemical. Generally, when we are looking at chemicals of concern, we're looking in parts per trillion. And finding that chemicals can be of concern at that low level, particularly when you're talking about a newborn or a small child. So you're saying that you're talking about 4 parts per million?
This is the reference dose that was established by the National Academy of Sciences.
That is
as producing no effect.
Thank you. And Representative Osman?
What was the cord blood? What amount was found in the cord blood?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I don't have that data in front of me, but it was far, far less than that number.
That's what I didn't want to get those two numbers mixed.
Okay. Representative Moe.
Mr. Chairman, I think you brought it up earlier. The real point is our own state agency has concerns about this substance breaking down into substances that we've already phased out because of their carcinogenic histories. I think that's the real issue. Does this, not what the level of this substance is, but if it in fact can break down, we have a state agency that's concerned about it in fact actually doing so. And Representative Osmond's point about, I know his history with in firefighting, and I have a first responder history myself. I think that there are other alternatives to preventing fires. You know, there are other retardants that we could use. We know that other products are using those.
Thank you, Representative Moe. And we do have one more testifier in opposition. You could ask her to come forward, Ms. Mackey. Is she still here? Mr. Mackey? Excuse me, Mr. Mackey. Thank you. And we are going to try to still fit in one of the bills, the other bills coming forward. So just a reminder, and we're going to try to be out of here by 6 o'clock because they're planning to use this room for this board, University of Minnesota Regents. So if you could state your name, please, and put the tape.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Steve Mackey. I would like to thank the committee for allowing me to testify in opposition of the HF 934. I grew up in northern Minnesota in Deer River, near Grand Rapids. I got my chemical engineering degree from the University of Minnesota.